Okay. Slightly later than advertised. Our final talk of this afternoon, direct from Spain. Carlos.
Hi.
Buenas tardes. Some people are just taking their seats. For the audience, you can obviously see the title in front of you. Carlos, I love the title of Carlos's book, Viajes con mi cura, which for an English audience, if you don't know, you know, based on travels with my aunt, travels with my priest. We look forward to the English version of that. We don't have a date yet, do we, Carlos? Is it the tentative date is summer next year now?
Yeah, hopefully in spring next year.
Early part of next year. Without further ado, Carlos, over to you. I'm glad the technology is working so well.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you, Chris. Well, I must say that I'm sorry I'm not physically with you today. As many of you know, I lost my dear wife 10 days ago. And until recently, I wouldn't have been able to gather the necessary strength to give this talk, even in virtual mode. Now the pain, of course, remains in a deep and permanent way, and I know I have to get used to living with it. My belief in eternal life helps me to cope with the loss, but I also have to learn to return to normal life. So 2 days ago, I decided that I had enough strength to give the presentation on this online mode. I'm convinced that the Friends of the Gangrene Birthplace Trust, who are my sort of family in England, deserve this added effort. I also want to thank the expressions of support received by these friends, who have made me feel very comforted. Especially, I want to express my gratitude to the support of John Osthaus in the darkest hour. And thank you all very much, and I'm sorry today I'm not 100%. Right, so I hope this presentation works well. Let me see. Can you see the next slide? Yes? Good. So in the 1970s and 1980s, Graham Greene traveled several times to the Iberian Peninsula to relax in the company of his Spanish friend, the priest and professor Leopoldo Durán. They undertook a total of 15 trips, almost always in summer. And the first of them inspired him to write his main Hispanic novel, Monsignor Quixote, published in 1982. The traveling custom began in 1976, but at first remained under the most discreet silence until 1980, when Green received an invitation from the mayor of Madrid to participate in a series of cultural meetings organized by the City Hall. From that moment on, Spanish public opinion was aware that the celebrated author holidayed in Spain in the company of a Galician priest. Shortly after Green's death in 1991, Durán started work on the memoir of their friendship, which came to light in 1994. Entitled Graham Greene, Friend and Brother, it developed anecdotes that Durán had already recounted in press articles and expanded details on some of the trips. Although he had taken precise annotations in his personal diaries, he did not offer a detailed chronicle of each journey and instead presented an embellished chronicle and an idealized semblance of his friend. With the exception of Richard Greene, Green's various biographers have used friend and brother as their only source to document Green's travels on the peninsula, and did not explore his specific movements or motivations beyond the enjoyment of friendship and rest as Durand presented it. It is true that several commentators have called attention to how, in addition to inspiring Monsignor Quixote, Green's friendship with Durand and their mutual confidences by the roots of Spain and Portugal helped to shore up the oscillating Christian belief of one who defined himself as a Catholic agnostic. But in general, Green's travels in Spain were initially described from a one-sided, idealized, and not entirely reliable perspective, which involved numerous contradictions and accuracies. One of the gaps that Durand's text does not clarify is the original reason why Green undertook his habit of traveling to the peninsula. Although at no time does he address this issue, his general tone points to pure rest and enjoyment of friendship. Oh, sorry, I'm missing one. Yeah. At some point he wrote, "Our trips through Spain and Portugal had nothing to do with tourism. They were something entirely different. We describe them as picnics, delightful jaunts in which we took our food with us and ate it in the fresh air of the countryside." However, this description is rather misleading, not only to account for the activities carried out, but also to explain the genesis of the traveling tradition. When Green made his first trip in July 1976, the relationship between the two was not properly a friendship, as shown in the previous correspondence. Today, I will try to shed a little light on the reasons that prompted Green to undertake the first visit in July 1976, invited by someone who was then almost a stranger, and to raise the possibility that, in order to give a convincing answer, Green's link to the British Secret Service and his facet as an agent or informant should be considered. These are a few pictures of some of the untold stories. For example, this deals with the creation of the Graham Greene Foundation in 1987, about which I briefly talked in one of my talks in Berkhamsted, right? So those of you who were there probably remember the guidelines. Right, so the idea that Monsignor Quixote was Green's favorite novel, according to Yvonne Cloetta. And well, yeah, before I get down to discussing my point, of course, as Chris has pointed out, this was the version of my book in Spanish, right, published in 2020, right, which will be published, well, an updated version and reduced version as well will come out hopefully in spring 2023, right, Viajes con mi cura. They didn't like the title very well, they prefer the subtitle, the Green's travels in Spain and Portugal, so I suppose they will do away with the main title, with Travels with My Priest. Maybe some of them didn't get the analogy, but anyway, this is the title of contest. I'm dealing with the first an introduction to Leopoldo Durand's life, then a day-to-day account of each of the travels. There were 15 travels, 15 trips, so I follow each of them day by day. Then I make a summary of the years of friendship with Green and the repercussions in Leopoldo Durand's life. Then at chapter four, I discuss the story of the Graham Greene Foundation, a very entertaining story. Then in chapter five, the story of the composition or the writing or the making of, as they say now, of Friend and Brother, again, bringing out a few interesting anecdotes. Then the final years of Leopoldo Durand and the conclusion and bibliography. First trip, map of the first trip, that was perhaps the longest of the 15 trips. And right, the third man, right, remember that each trip Leopoldo Durand hired, so to speak, hired one of his former students or young friends to act as driver and companion, and they jocularly called him the third man. And Miguel Fernández Aurelio Verde, who sadly passed away a few years ago, and Octavio Victoria. Right, so let me just start with the issue of Green's involvement with the MI6. Well, of course, this is an open secret, so to speak. Green's long and productive career reveals that he was a writer very much focused on his work, and that assisted by his secretaries, literary agents, publishers, and other advisors, he always took great care with the numerous ramifications of his work. But in addition to his varied facets as an author, Green also wanted to take sides in the international politics of his time, something for which his tenure in the British Secret Service during World War II may have prepared him. Indeed, as it is very well known, he was recruited in the summer of 1941 by the Secret Intelligence Service to Section 5, counter-espionage, and after a period of training, he was assigned to Freetown. Then he returned to England in March 1943, and from the London headquarters, located in 7 Rider Street, he was in charge of the counter-espionage subsection of the Iberian Peninsula, under the direction of King Philby. Among his duties were to respond to messages from British agents infiltrated in Portugal, evaluate decoded information from Enigma, or catalog known Axis agents and try to win them over. Now, in May 1944, according to his own testimony, Green resigned, perhaps to avoid being appointed head of the Iberian section after Philby's reappointment as the head of Section 9. He went on to perform other duties in the Political Intelligence Department and the Political Warfare Executive. Thus, apparently, at the end of the war, Green left the SIS. But there is evidence to suggest that Green never ceased to be in contact with his country's international intelligence, even if he was just an informant. The unauthorized biographer Michael Selden provides a cabinet office report stating that Green, following his resignation from the intelligence service, and I quote, continued to serve SIS informally until the early 1980s. In exchange for expenses, he gave his help to the organization in many places, most notably Vietnam, Poland, China, and Russia. Whether a particular trip was subsidized by SIS or not, he routinely gave its officers information from his foreign visits when he believed it might be useful. His interest in visiting some of the most conflict-ridden points on the planet, let's add Kenya, Cuba, Haiti, Paraguay, Panama, Nicaragua, El Salvador, Hungary, other places in Indochina, etc., was often justified by journalistic commissions, which in turn could provide inspiration to write successful novels. Martin Pierce goes further. You know, Martin Pierce is the biographer, the latest biographer of his relative, Maurice Oldfield, the head of the MI6. And he states that Green was recruited as an agent, right? Not as an informant, but as an agent again in 1955. By Fergie Dempster, station master in Saigon and partner of the later head of MI6, Maurice Oldfield. Pierce does not provide further evidence for this statement, but knows that in making his biography of Oldfield, he met with numerous SIS officers, secretaries, and agents who must remain anonymous. If true, it would imply that Green re-engaged as an agent and not only as an informant 11 years after his apparent resignation. Yvonne Cloeta, his lovers for 30 years, concludes in her memoir that Green worked with the Secret Services until the end of his life. And she provides some examples, such as his missions in Indochina in the 1950s, General Delattre's conviction that Green was a spy, his contacts in Russia with double agent Kim Philby, of which Green reported to the Foreign Office, the continued presence of former, perhaps former or not so former, MI6 members in the surroundings of the Côte d'Azur, where Green lived from 1966, and provides names, the ones that you have on your screen, right, of former MI6 members who happened to be around, right? To this, perhaps we should add a few more, like, for example, his next-door neighbor, R. Hudson Smith, according to Richard Green, a retired spy, and also the fact that a few days before he died, Green, as a farewell, arranged for the sending of classified documents to various people connected to the world of espionage, including Marie-Francoise Alain and John Cairncross. Well, yes, this facet of Green is an open secret, but the verification of the ins and outs will have to await the future works of other scholars and the classification of British intelligence documents. As far as his travels in Portugal and Spain are concerned, it provides a credible context for placing his first visit at the beginning of the traveling tradition that came later. The origin dates back to the summer of 1975. From Green's correspondence with Yvonne, we can partially reconstruct a rather enigmatic scenario. Green, by then, had been living in Antibes. This is a picture of Maurice Oldfield, the sea in the 70s. And from his London hotel, the Ritz Hotel, in the summer of 1975, Green wrote to Yvonne and stated that he missed Chile. Sorry. Cuba and Haiti, and that he would like to leave now for Panama or Hungary. At this time, he had replaced his veteran personal secretary, Josephine Braid, with his own sister, Elizabeth Dennis, who had worked in intelligence with her husband, Rodney, and who had been responsible for Green's recruitment in 1941. So in the same summer of 1975, Green recounted to Yvonne his interview with Maurice Oldfield, right, with the head of the Secret Service, C. I had to go up today to London to have lunch with C of the Secret Service. We were by ourselves, and it was most interesting. There is evidence that Green met regularly with Oldfield, who had worked in Cairo with Elizabeth during the war, and whom Green knew since the 1950s, and it seems very likely that they would regularly discuss security issues, as pointed out by Brennan. Green, shortly after his interview with C, does not refer to leisure trips, but to missions. And it is significant that he chose to approach Portugal as an alternative to not being able to travel to Hungary. Under these circumstances, he unexpectedly got an appointment to meet one of his scholars and admirers, a Spanish priest and university professor, Leopoldo Durán, on the 20th of August, 1975. It opened up the possibility of establishing a contact in a country that had always attracted Green. Indeed, Spain had especially fascinated Green since his youth, although his knowledge about the country appears to have been rather limited. The Iberian Peninsula was in fact the destination for his trip abroad. His first trip abroad, first travel with my aunt, because in the summer of 1920, as an interruption of the 6 months of his psychoanalytical therapy, he traveled with his aunt Eva and some cousins to Lisbon, making a day stopover in La Coruña and Vigo. His second unpublished novel, written at the end of his university years, focused on a Hispanic motif, the Carlist Wars. Years later, Green rescued the Hispanic context in his fifth written novel and third published novel, Rumor at Nightfall. His knowledge of the country still remained scarce. He admitted that, I quote, all I knew of the Carlist Wars was drawn from Carlyle's Life of John Sterling. Green renewed his interest in Spain after the outbreak of the Civil War in 1936. Although perhaps as a recently converted Catholic, he remained rather lukewarm in his support for the Republican government, agreeing back the balanced nationalists as they fought Franco without abandoning their Catholic principles. And Green even made a feeble effort to try and get to the front. 2 years later, the Spanish War found a place in Green's fiction, although rather obliquely in his novel, The Confidential Agent, published in 1939. He never mentioned the name Spain or Spanish, but it is quite obvious that the whole story is about the Spanish Civil War. During his time as an SIS agent, between 1941 and 1944, Green appears to have devoted himself more to Portugal than to Spain. Although the two countries were closely linked for British intelligence, diplomacy, and propaganda services on the peninsula. In fact, with the end of the Spanish War and the start of World War II, a priority objective of the British diplomatic effort in Spain and Portugal was to ensure that the neutrality of both countries and to thwart any possible alliance with the Axis that could put obstacles in the movement of troops and materials across the peninsula and lose Gibraltar and the Atlantic and Mediterranean ports. Green's head in section 5 of the peninsula was the controversial King Philby, who had built a cover for a person akin to the Franco regime. The United Kingdom prioritized the intervention of officials, officers, and agents of Catholic religious sensitivity, as it was felt that this would make it easier to establish more trusted relations with the new Spanish rulers. Graham Greene and a large group of colleagues and friends possessed such a profile, including Tom Burns, a key figure in Greene's relations with Spain. He was his publisher, the one who had encouraged Green to write about the persecution of Catholics in Mexico, a major contact for his first ministerial services in wartime, and also a lifelong friend. In 1940, Burns was sent to Madrid with a delicate mission. The Ministry of Information and the Foreign Office had set up a network of press and information offices in Spain, whose main task was to win the propaganda war and to gain time to prepare the counteroffensive, preventing Franco's Spain from joining the Axis. Between 1940 and 1946, Burns used his many contacts within the Franco regime to obtain inside information, discover trading points, and recruit double agents for the Allied cause. In view of this context, it is suggested that Green's second trip to Spain was at the behest of Tom Burns. In Monsignor Quijote's dedication, Green acknowledges that it was Burns who inspired his first, actually second, visit to Spain in 1946, during which he most likely visited the British embassy. Green would return to Spain once or twice more before embarking on his series of journeys with Leopoldo Durán in 1976, although the dates are unclear. One appears to have been in the late 40s, when he visited Cordoba and Seville, among other locations. We don't know whether these trips were integrated among his intelligence missions or there were other motivations. But if Burns was still behind these trips, it must be borne in mind that after his retirement from Spain in 1946, Burns had allegedly resumed his career as a publisher in England. But as his son and biographer claims, Jimmy Burns Marañón, he maintained a secret informal relationship with the British and USA intelligence services after returning to public life as a publisher, a cover for overseas travel and the securing of a variety of sources of information. The similarity of this pattern, also followed by Green as a Catholic Englishman in charge of the Iberian Peninsula during wartime and officially withdrawn from intelligence but active on other fronts, is really striking. Returning to the summer of 1975, in a June letter to Yvonne, Green stated his intention to approach Portugal, quote, to see Maria Newell, who, in addition to being an old friend, also seems to have been engaged with the Secret Service. And Green adds, the position seems interesting now. Indeed, in Portugal, the 1974 Carnation Revolution had ended nearly half a century of the Estado Novo. But in the following months, the consolidation of the democratic order was no easy task. Tensions between the three republican tendencies, conservative, socialist, and communist, provoked an unstable climate that produced five provisional governments in 2 years. The summer of 1975 is known as the hot summer. Marked by the fall of the government of Vasco Gonçalves, demonstrations in the main cities, occupation of Radio Renascença by radical forces, occupation of latifundios by landless farmers, and recruitment of armed guerrillas by landowners to defend their properties. So, indeed, a very hot summer. On the 10th of July, Green wrote to Yvonne again and informed her of his intention to leave early to observe the Portuguese Revolution, although at the moment he appeared to be suffering from a characteristic mood slump and complained about the comedies I have to play. But eventually, in the first half of August, he made his planned trip to Portugal to meet Maria Newell, who resided in Quinta da Piedade, a beautiful house in the town of Colares, on the outskirts of Sintra. Who was this lady that Green would have to visit obligatorily during his future visits to Spain? An English Catholic with a reputation for being a beauty, her maiden name was Mary Margaret Poland. She married Commander James Mackindo in 1916, with whom she had a daughter, Mary. They divorced in 1928, and 3 years later, she married another officer, Lieutenant Commander Keith W. Newell. He suffered a scam at the hands of George Howard, Earl of Carlisle, and committed suicide in 1938 by shooting himself with a firearm. From 1940 to 1942, Maria joined the Mechanized Transport Corps, a uniformed women-only corps that provided transportation to military officers and foreign dignitaries during World War II. During this period, she fell in love with an influential jurist working as a deputy director for the Ministry of Information, Walter Monckton, who would become minister from 1951 with Churchill. The relationship lasted a while, but in 1947, without warning, Monckton abandoned her for Biddy Carlisle, precisely the wife of the Earl who had conned Commander Newell. Maria was shattered, and perhaps to turn the page, began a new life in Kenya. In 1949, she built a farm on her own in Najuru, and according to Duran, in addition to being a farmer, she was the head of the English Nurses of the Red Cross. Green met her in 1953, when he traveled to Kenya to cover the news of the Mau Mau rebels, and stayed at her home, and they are likely to have been occasional lovers. Correspondence with Green reveals that in the mid-1960s, Maria was already living in Portugal, and from 1967, she settled in Quinta da Piedade, owned by the Marchioness of Cadaval, Olga Robles Soares de Melo de Cadaval, a very long name. Maria Newell's role may be a key piece in understanding why Green regularly undertook his trips around the peninsula in the 1970s. The correspondence preserved at Boston College reveals that communication between them intensified from Green's summer visit in 1975 to witness the last revolts. Until then, they had exchanged little more than complimentary Christmas greetings. But from this meeting onwards, Green and Maria Newell seem to have been in renewed harmony. Why did this octogenarian and invalid lady with daughters and grandchildren in England remain an expatriate in Sintra instead of living comfortably in her family house in Mickleton? What did she do there? In her letters, she often mentions distribution of aid to refugees and humanitarian missions that she oversees. She also describes street riots, repression by authorities, cases of political prisoners entering or leaving prison, or enigmatic shipments delivered by personal mail. Often the people are referred to by acronyms or pseudonyms, and at other times Green is invited to, quote, read between the lines, or she says that she cannot be very explicit in writing. It is very significant that while on holiday at an English family home in November 1975, when there was a military uprising and a consequent state of emergency, instead of remaining in safety at home, she was quick to advance and return to Portugal. She wrote, "I hurried back last Tuesday, 25th, as I heard there was trouble brewing." Maria O'Maria Newell also received personalities from the church, such as the Papal Nuncio in Portugal and other bishops and cardinals. For her intense social activity, it is possible that Newell benefited from the neighborhood and friendship of her hostess, Olga Nicolis of Roviland Alvarez Pereira de Melo, Marchioness of Cadaval, owner of Quinta da Piedade, and sponsor of arts. The Marchioness was friends with personalities of her time from various cultural, political, or social fields. How much time is left, Chris? Yes, just to measure up a little. No? Okay, I'll go on. Right, so in August 1975, as mentioned before, there was an event that would change the life of the Princeton University professor Leopoldo Durán. His lunch at the Ritz would ring. Durán had sent his first letter to the writer in 1964, presenting himself as an admirer and manifesting his intention to study Green's work from a theological perspective. The results of his analysis would eventually form two doctoral theses and a handful of academic articles. In the long decade that this initial epistolary relation lasted, Durán became more daring over the years and intensified his correspondence by sending the very publications resulting from his scholarship. Green, meanwhile, who received hundreds, thousands of letters from readers and admirers, kept an educated distance and on most occasions channeled his courteous answers through his secretary, Josephine Ray. It is even possible that the priest's insistence was not entirely welcome. Thus, in an annotation addressed to his boss, Ray received Durán's new shipment with some apprehension and wrote on the margins of his letter, "This is the priest who sends the massive bound green leather books on you." The Green clearly took the initiative occurred in a letter in April 1975, in which he acknowledged receipt of the last consignment of articles, while informing him that he could visit Spain in June on the occasion of the filming of the honorary consul. Although such a filming project did not go ahead, from this moment onwards, meeting Green would become a priority for Durán. Indeed, his perseverance was rewarded when, on the 20th of August 1975, not 1973, as he wrongly states in Friend and Brother, he was able to meet his idol for lunch at the Ritz Hotel. The only account of this meeting comes from Durán himself, according to which they soon entered into lively conversation about the church, various Catholic orders and institutions, the writer's troubles, his recent work, etc. It apparently lasted 5 hours. And although it may not have been the love at first sight that Durán intimated in his memoirs, it certainly paved the way for Durán to host the writer the following summer. It makes sense that the political situation in Spain during that period may have become a decisive incentive for Green to be interested in resuming the relationship, since just 10 days after the death of dictator Francisco Franco, he wrote to Durán to arrange an urgent visit that same December. Durán, who did not seem willing to miss the opportunity to host his literary idol, accepted unconditionally. And although in the end Green rewrote to postpone it, he would take up the initiative in another letter on the 8th of January 1976, which reads as follows. Well, you have this on your screen. July would be, so far as one can see ahead, the best possible time. Notice how he mentions Christian Casanova, we will refer to him later, and Maria Newell, for a few days to see my old friend at Sintra. Shortly after receiving confirmation of Durán's unconditional availability, Green informed Maria Newell, I quote, "I have half promised to go to Spain to stay with a priest who writes intelligent books about me the second week of July. It would be nice if after looking around there, I could come and see you at Sintra." Notice the distant tone, right, that deflects attention from the fact that it was Green who raised the visit. And also notice the expression "looking round." Green included a stop of clear political interest. Soon afterwards, he wrote to Durán indicating that he would be interested in visiting the Basque Country, then the most conflicted region in Spain due to the frequent attacks of the terrorist group ETA. But as the planned journey approached, Green suffered from his characteristic mood swings and sometimes expressed his desire, a little desire, to set out. Another letter to Maraya, dated 11th of June, he stated that he, I quote, "shuddered at the thought of his visit to Spain, but consoled himself with the possibility of exploring the Basque territory, where also the climate would be cooler." A few days later, he made it clear again that the trip was not for pleasure. Referring to his visit, which had been delayed from the initial plan, he wrote that he would like to postpone it permanently. Again, he emphasized in that letter that the most interesting thing was to observe the focus of greatest conflict, the Basque Country, which he had come close to visiting during the Civil War, and now associated in his mind with the problem of Northern Ireland, from which he had just returned. In that letter to Maria Newark, he wrote, "I don't think it would be nearly as horrible as the 4 days spent in Belfast." Indeed, Green had traveled there in the summer of 1976, a few days before his Spanish trip, and in Ireland he had met with people of culture and politics, such as Geoffrey Fitt, leader of Social Democratic and Labour Party, the most voted nationalist party in Northern Ireland during the Troubles. The conflict in Northern Ireland was one of the priorities of the SIS in the 1970s. Despite being a national territory, Prime Minister Edward Heath had proposed that coordinated action between the two agencies, MI5 and MI6, be in place since 1970. Maurice Oldfield, head of the latter from 1973 to 1978, played an important role in discrediting the Northern Irish terrorist action and seeking a peaceful solution, and was convinced that there was a mutual connection and support between the Basque ETA and the Irish terrorists of the IRA and INLA, according again to his biographer Pierce. To understand Green's possible role in Spain, it is appropriate to approach the modus operandi of Oldfield. Possibly the person most likely to have been responsible for keeping Green as an asset of British intelligence after the war. But anyway, point out that, according to his biographer, from his early positions, he sought to combine classified intelligence work with ground recognition. And I quote from Pierce, "The diligent intelligence officer's requirement of letting him see how the people lived, what their motivation and opinions were, and building enforced local connections at grassroots level." This is very important in order to understand Green's approach to his Spanish travels. For his work, Oldfield considered essential to have external informants who could provide a counterpoint to the reports of payroll agents, anticipating that sometimes they could be pressured to produce novel material at all costs. One of Oldfield's most effective methods of securing intelligence was to use unofficial agents or friends known to him personally to back up or occasionally contradict what he was being told by his official salaried officers. In this context, one of Oldfield's preferred occupational sectors was journalists, but it's also significant that Oldfield frequently relied on priests as regular contacts. Probably the most notable group in terms of the sourcing of agents by Maurice, though, was the clergy. In every country he traveled, he would visit churches and get to know the priests and their assistants. These people had their own networks across their communities that tended to encompass a wide cross-section of society. Oldfield was a man of Anglo-Catholic sensibility, and during his intelligence work to counter the riots in Northern Ireland, he demonstrated a great capacity for dialogue with the Catholic clergy, and even recruited clerics as informants who could give him names of people involved in the violence. Therefore, it makes sense that Oldfield may have strongly recommended Green to take advantage of his contact with that Spanish admirer who, in addition to being a university professor, was a priest. In short, tourism or pleasure do not appear to have been Green's main motivations for his first trip to Spain, and instead could have related to his desire to know the political evolution of the country from within and to inform the intelligence service. But two new reasons will be added to repeat this visit and turn the Hispanic summer into an annual tradition. Judging by the correspondence that was exchanged between the two from 1976, Green came to befriend Duran, and he proved to be an excellent host, able to mobilize several of his associates to obtain an excellent reception in various parts of the peninsula. Duran's dimension as a scholar of Green's work also had added value. In addition, Green would appreciate the possibility of filling a vacant gap among his friendship, that of the sympathetic priest, who would be forgiving with his sins of the flesh, but at the same time willing to give him sacramental absolution in articulo mortis. In the past, he had frequented the friendship of priests for whom he had a personal affinity, such as Philip Caraman or Thomas Gilby, but for various reasons, Green came to feel betrayed by both. But it's possible that Green saw Duran as the finest candidate to fill that gap for more than a decade. In fact, Duran's readiness to attend him sacramentally in case of need arose from the first voyage of 1976 and would be repeated often in the future, practically on virtually every trip. Right, soon the person who was once the priest who sent massive bound green leather book on you soon became an esteemed friend. In addition, although he does not appear to have previous drinking habits, the man was willing to compromise. And accompanying him is in demanding alcoholic rituals, even at the risk of succumbing to the rhythm imposed by his guest. Right, we do not know the degree to which Green would report what he saw in Spain to his country's intelligence service. It is very likely that his main initial objective, the Basque country as a focus of conflict, would disappoint his expectations. Instead of armed patrols through the ruined streets and explosions, as he saw in Belfast, he contemplated placid crowds of tourists in swimsuits in the Concha beach of San Sebastian, or the delicacies of the Arzak restaurant. In fact, on the remaining 14 trips, he did not pass through the Basque country again, nor did he propose to do so. It seems that his priorities soon moved to a genuine enjoyment of rest and friendship, suddenly enriched by the inspiring outburst that came upon him on the 1977 voyage, when he realized that he should write a novel about Spain and about a character so peculiar, at least as he knew Spanish friend, who would eventually become Monsignor Quixote. Indeed, Green returned to Spain in July 1977 with the ambition of turning his new friend into a literary character, recreating anecdotes from his travels with the comic background of Cervantine and Unamunian echoes, and also offering impression of post-Franco Spain, reflections on the collaboration between Marxism and Christianity, and some criticism of traditional Catholic doctrine. Right, that's the last section, dealing with a few more friends, things with spirits, enjoyment. This was the second trip, right? 1977, the itinerary, that was very long as well. And from now on, Portugal and Sintra would become a compulsory stop. Right. Now, just a mention of another dimension of Green's troubles. So I have referred to the motivation for the first trip. But in 1980, Green tried to attempt something that he had achieved in other Latin American countries. It was through the intercession of a man named Christian Casanova that he came in contact with the mayor of Madrid, Enrique Tierno Galván. Tierno Galván invited Green to an official invitation framed within the import that the new mayor of Madrid intended to give to the cultural life of the capital. That invitation included the silver medal of the city, attending press conferences, receptions, an open colloquium in the house of the villa. So everything that Green detested. If until then Green had vehemently insisted that his time in Spain should remain in absolute secrecy, in July 1980, he decided to accept a public invitation that would compromise not only the anonymity of his trip, but of future ones. The price for which he apparently sold his privacy seems extremely low: a plane ticket and a three-night hotel stay to attend the consistory events. However, it seems plausible to assume that Green had a special interest in contacting one of the most influential elected leaders of the Spanish Socialist Party, then on the rise, 2 years before it won the general election that would keep Felipe González as government president until 1994. In other Hispanic countries where Green has exercised this peculiar political activity, his modus operandi consisted of strengthening personal ties with some leftist leader in power, and from that privileged position, moving with some ease through the high political spheres of the country. He had done so in Chile with Salvador Allende, in Panama with Omar Torrijos, in Nicaragua with Daniel Ortega, and in Cuba with Fidel Castro. Chris Hall knows everything about it in his wonderful book, Our Man Now in Havana, which I strongly recommend. One cannot help wondering at Green's exceptional social skills to engage in a considerable degree of friendship with Hispanic leaders without barely speaking their language. Skills that, for example, enabled him to be present at the signing of the Canal Treaty in 1977 as a representative of Panama in the international delegation. And that same year, it is remarkable that he approached Quinta da Piedade in the hope of being able to hold a meeting with Mario Soares, the recent Portuguese prime minister and leader of the Socialist Party. Right? So in 1980, Green also got to know the first socialist mayor of Madrid. Since the transition, the beginning of democracy in Spain, this was Tierno Galván, Enrique Tierno Galván. You probably remember that there is a character in Monsignor Quixote named after him, Professor Galván. And it could even be said that he entered into a sort of friendship with him. Father Durán, who accompanied him at all times, participated in this rapprochement, although he considered himself politically the polar opposite of Tierno, and so withdrew the social changes that socialism was promoting. However, in his diaries, Durán does not note Green's possible political intentionality in accepting such an invitation, and instead focuses on other personal issues that affected his outlook, such as the affronts, real or imaginary, that he was subject to in his role as friend and interpreter of the writer. This, coupled with his natural naivety or perhaps discretion, prevented him from interpreting the priorities of the writer, who on this visit intended to contact the leader of the opposition, Felipe González, and also the general secretary of the Communist Party, recently legalized in Spain, Santiago Carrillo. In this endeavor, again, we may find traces of the networking that characterized Green's likely handler at MI6, Maurice Oldfield, who understood, I quote from Pierce, the need to get to know opposition leaders in the countries he visited as much as serving government ministers, as such leaders were likely, very likely themselves to take part at some point. On the other hand, both Quirnos and Gonzalez's trajectories open up possibilities for one of Green's interests at that time, the collaboration between Marxism, socialism, and Christianity. We do not know whether Green openly asked Tierno Galván to introduce him to González. The official schedule was tight, and both leaders were political rivals within emerging Spanish socialism. So perhaps the old professor, as Tierno Galván was popularly nicknamed, was not the best vehicle to reach the leader of the Socialist Party. But what is certain is that Green sought to maintain that human bond with Tierno Galván, and on his subsequent visits, he never missed a meal with the mayor until the latter's illness and subsequent death in January 1986. Right. Finally, a few more friends. We admit that espionage was among Green's initial priorities. One might wonder to what extent he spied on Spain and Portugal throughout his 15 trips between 1976 and 1989. But the main source for documenting this, the diaries and memoirs of Leopoldo Durán, offer no indication of this facet. For him, Green came to rest, to enjoy the surroundings, wine, friendship. He could not even find anything mysterious on the obligatory visits to Maria Newell in Sintra. For him, Mrs. Newell was just an old friend of the author, an exquisite lady of deep Catholic piety and enough culture to live up to the long and heated discussion. In short, it is easy to imagine some enigmatic in Green's visit to this resolute old woman, who repeatedly insisted that Green dispense with the third man, for whoever he may be, he seemed to inconvenience the tranquility of the encounters. These clues, along with the mysterious allusions in the letters of 1974-1975, lead us to suspect that some intelligence or diplomatic mission was carried out in Quinta de Piedade in Sintra. But there were a few more friends of his Spanish trips. One was, of course, Christian Casanova, the link to mayor, the mayor of Madrid, but also the mysterious appearance of the reporter and notorious Hungarian spy, Laszlo Robert, who even wanted to invite himself on the 1981 journey. Or the presence of a committee of Sandinista Nicaraguans housed in the same Madrid hotel as Green, who discussed revolutionary affairs with them. One could even speculate on the figure of Anne-Marie Comert, who works for Argos Vergara, one of the publishers of Green's work in Spanish. And Durán records several interviews with Comert, a figure emerging intermittently in his diaries without too many explanations being provided. Her appearances could be attributed to the professional negotiation between author and publisher to secure the rights of Green's latest works. But when one investigates Comert's past, the fact emerges that a few years ago she was Anne-Marie Walters, a decorated special operation executive agent who had operated in Nazi-occupied France. A new coincidence? Coming up, in any case, Green's informative role, in the absence of a better term, in Spain and Portugal, remain conjectures, based on clues related to the timing of his journeys and loose threads from written documents about them, including the innocent testimonies of Durán. That's, for example, the repetition of talks on whether or not Spain should enter the then European Economic Community could be interpreted as a possible objective of Green's observation on Spain. And while Durán does not expressly acknowledge the slightest espionage activity, it is very likely that he would have kept the secret in the event that he had been aware. Each of his diary booklets begins with a singular statement. I swear that everything I write on this notebook will try to be as close as possible to what the two of us discussed, avoiding, of course, even mentioning what should never be mentioned. The most immediate interpretation is that he omits intimate conversations, or more specifically, confidences or even sacramental confessions. But it could also refer by Green's express wish to his intelligence activity. It is obvious that Durán's diaries are written not only for personal consumption, but to be read by posterity. On the other hand, it is logical that the secret activity may have remained secret, and it should continue so until the official files are declassified, if ever. In short, it will still take a few years to learn in more detail about what aspects of Spanish life Graham Greene informed his government of when he passed through Spain, and what possible repercussions his reports may have had on UK international politics. And this is the end of my talk. Just let me add, in loving memory of my one Gemma, thank you for these 22 years. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Carlos, for giving us that fascinating, detailed and interesting talk in such difficult personal circumstances. What occurred to me, you know, as well as all the, you know, these miraculous coincidences of the timing of his visit, was just the access that Greene had, the sort of access that British diplomats and British politicians could never enjoy with such people of political importance, both in Spain, as you mentioned there, and also in passing in Latin America. I think we've got time for a few questions before the birthday toast. Does anybody have anything to ask Carlos? Or any comments? That's what really occurs to me, is just the, you know, the sheer number of coincidences and the access that he enjoyed, that just opened door. His fame, his the fact that just opened doors for him everywhere he went, and just some of those, you know, figures of local and national political importance, sort of across the political spectrum, you seem to be indicating there. And but also the Portugal as well. I wasn't aware of the I'd sort of forgotten about the, obviously all the important political events that were occurring in Portugal at that time after the Carnation Revolution. So in terms of your book, Carlos, are there big differences between Viajes Comicura and the book that's coming out next year, or is it simply slightly updated version?
Yeah, and slightly reduced as well. The publishers in Oxford University Press made a point that they should reduce the book by 1/7. I had repeated a few anecdotes. Well, my original book takes 400 pages, so I felt entitled to repeat a couple of anecdotes, more than once. And, well, the advice they gave me is that to cut down on some repetitions, so the English version is slightly updated. Of course, I am, for example, quoting your own book and Richard Greene's book. And also reduced by 1/6, something like that, right? So I think it was good advice. So I think the English product is better balanced. So yes, let's cross finger that it comes out in spring 1923. Oxford University Press takes things, I mean, since it's an ancient institution, several centuries old, they are in no hurry to have the book out. Initially, I had the hope that it might be ready for this year's festival, right? Back in the day, right, in summer or in this spring, but they made it clear that it won't be possible, right? So let's hope that it will come out in May, June 2023.
Listen, Carlos, we're of course looking forward to that contribution that most the Greene fans here can read, not being Spanish speakers or readers of Spanish, most of them. So very much looking forward to that. And of course, looking forward to meeting you in person at at a future festival, either next year or the year after, sometime soon.
Yes.
Of course, all our thoughts are very much with you, and you know, we're shortly to have the birthday toast, which you'll have partaken in a few times, and of course we'll be thinking of you as well as other people when we do that, and indeed your wife.
So thank you so much.
Thank you, Carlos.
Thank you.
Un fuerte abrazo y estamos en contacto. Si necesitas ayuda con el manuscrito del libro en inglés,
estoy aquí. Gracias, Chris.
Estoy aquí.
Gracias.
Okay.
Muchas gracias.
Un abrazo
fraterno. Adiós.